The mother is so oppressed by this system. Her lot in life is dealing with all of the screaming kids that dad has no interest in helping with. She is left to clean up after this domineering, demanding, ungrateful slob who is the tyrant in charge of the family. My question is, Justin, why do you hate women so much? Run your home and your dough like a biblical boss. Welcome to Abraham's Wallet. I am your host, Steve Manuel. I'm going to be joined today by a repeat guest on the podcast. And I want to give you a little heads up about who Justin Wolfenberg is before we jump into the conversation. I met Justin when he and I were both on staff at a mega church in town. This is before both of us were even thinking of the way that we presently are about family. But I'm asking Justin about the topic of women in the biblical family model. What about women? What about mom? What is our philosophy? What's our doctrine on women? Are our wives simply there as auxiliary members of our households and they do all the work that we don't want to do? Well, what's the thought there? Before we jump over to that conversation, I just wanted to address one thing, and that is that we are already in a special season here at Abraham's Wallet. We observe the fact that you don't have to try, for instance, during the holiday season, to go looking for treats, for instance. They will come looking for you. We had people bring us cookies, and my daughters would come home from an event going like, hey, there's peppermint ice cream for everybody that we brought home. What? Peppermint ice cream? I'm not saying no to that. And there was some point where I told my wife, what about the cherry pie that my good friend Terry gave us? Are we ever going to eat that thing? She said, there's just too much, honey. There's just too much good stuff to eat. Yeah, it's a problem. It's a problem of modern American life. You deal with the feeling of, how do I train my kids when there's too much all the time? How do I create a culture in my family, for my own heart, where there's we go from plenty to too much? How does that make me lean and mean for the kingdom, which is what I want? And so we invented a little thing called low dough Feb. We take the shortest month of the year, February, and we say, what if we got by on less for 1 month? What if we spent as little as possible? What if we took the entertainment budget and the clothing budget and the eating out budget, and we took those to zero for 1 month? What if we said we're not eating steaks and salmon and shrimp for 1 month? We're going to major on beans and rice for a month, and we will get, you know, maybe a discount. I don't know about discount. We'll get the family size chicken breast, the frozen chicken breasts, and we're just going to make do on less. And we just take 1 month and we go, how little can we live on for a month? Just this morning, I was at a coffee shop. I got to go to a coffee shop. I'm going to be meeting this guy. That's a good place to meet. We're going to talk. And I, when I walked in, I thought a latte here costs $6.50, but a cup of tea costs $3. I'm getting the cup of tea. It's low dough Feb time. So we're just making very practical choices like that to shrink our expenditures. And we think it's good for our hearts. It's good to say no to yourself. There's a verse in Titus that says that the Spirit of God teaches us how to say no. And so it's good to say no. Boy, I see something on Amazon that's on sale. I've been looking for that thing. It's going to have to wait. The answer is no right now. So I just want to give a little plug for Low Dough Feb. I know that our regulars are doing it. I see them and talk to them on our online home, our hangout, which we call Ur. That's where Abraham is from. And that's our little spot. So we're discussing, you know, current events with our with our people. But for lots of you, you might have thought, well, we're in the middle of February. Nobody's mentioned Lodo Feb. Are they doing that this year? The short answer is yes, we're doing that this year, which means that we're spending less. And of course, we're saving more. And that's a great way to have some discussions about, do we want to give away the delta between what we normally have budgeted and what we actually spend in Lodo Feb, which is going to be, I hope significant. So I just want to give a plug for Lodo Feb. If you've never tried it, try it for a week. I think you'll find it to be a very helpful discipline if you can get everybody on board with, we're going to say no to ourselves and our wants. We're going to minimize our wants for 1 week. And we're going to maybe go through the closet and see what here do we not use and not need. Let's get rid of it. Anyways, that's Lodo Feb. I've taken too much time in introduction. I want you to get you right to this conversation with a fascinating and provocative young man who I greatly enjoy. I'll throw it right to the conversation with Justin Wolfenberg. Justin, you look like you're joining us from the space station Mir or some futuristic construction project. There's lights. There's a concrete wall beside you. Are you off the grid? Where are you?
So we're down in Fort Thomas, Kentucky at the Stanios residence, and we're building an addition right now. And the crew is out there on the job site, and I'm in their current existing basement.
Got you. Yes. Well, yes. Yeah. Stanio was on a recent episode. And I that aired right at the beginning of January, as a matter of fact. And he talked about this giant renovations happening at his house. So your crew's in charge of that, huh?
Yes. Yeah.
How long are you going to be working in the freezing snow? For months?
Yeah. I mean, well, we're working hard. Hopefully we'll have it insulated in about 3 or 4 weeks. So we've got a couple more weeks.
Wow. I mean,
we've got it somewhat. We're under roof and we have plastic up over some of the windows, and so a big heater running. So we got a comfortable about 30, 35 out there right now.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I always joke around, like lots of rich people pay money for cold plunges, and I'm getting paid for my own cold plunge. That's a different right. way of thinking about life, right?
Yes. Okay, well, let me set you up into start picking your brain about today's topic. Here's my setup, Justin. You say that you're an advocate for this patriarchal family model. And the word on the street for the patriarchal, which just means father-led family model, is that for men, this model is a cakewalk. You walk into a room, you point your finger, everyone does what you say, you get the biggest chair, you eat the meals you want, you push back from the table, other minions are left to clean up. And the mother in this scenario, she is so put upon, and the popular word would be she is so oppressed by this system. Her true desires are squelched. There she gets stomped on a regular basis. And her lot in life is dealing with all of the screaming kids that dad has no interest in helping with. And she is left to clean up after this domineering, demanding, ungrateful slob who is the tyrant in charge of the family. So when I think of you and the patriarchal family model, I guess my question is, Justin, why do you hate women so much?
I guess you're setting us up to get in big trouble because these are one of those taboo topics. If you talk about it, no matter what you say, you'll be branded in that way that you're describing. So yes, it's a hard one to talk about, but I think we do such people a disservice if we won't get into some of these topics. If we're
afraid
to talk about some of the harder things that could be. Because, I mean, when I think a lot about this, it's like, you know, is there an order to the family? Is there a created order to the family? And if there is, where does it come from? Right? Like, So I think you and I would agree, we'd go all the way back to Genesis as sort of a blueprint of a created order of a family. And I think what helps me so much think about this is, if I think about this as like, there's two components to my relationship, for simplicity's sake, with my wife. There's the relational side, where we both really love and care for each other, okay? And that's obviously super important, and God willing, I've gotten better at it after 20 years of marriage. I wouldn't not write any books on it, but I've gotten better, and I hope to get better and better as I grow and mature. But there's another side of thinking about our families, and if you can think about it as like a team, like a family team. If you use the thought process of like a sports team or a military or a business, it would be just absolutely insane if you came in and said, everybody has the same role. We're all equal. There's nobody in charge, right? No business runs that way. The military could never run that way. No sports team runs that way. There's captains, head coaches, assistant coaches. There's an order to any team that is on a mission. And the way God designs things and why there's so much controversy on this stuff is God designs his systems, whatever they might be, to be abused easily. So there, you don't have to sniff around long till you find this system of the family, of the father leading, being abused. Unfortunately, I wish I could just point back and say, see, this is always goes well. But the reality is there's been a lot of pain in this system. Just like the system of sex, just like the system of money, all of these things get abused because God is testing us to see how we'll handle this kind of power. And so my premise, what I say to people all the time, and they really don't like this, is I say, your family has a leader, someone who is the dominant influencer of it. You cannot tell me when you cannot have two 50-50 people. Because at some point, someone's driving it, someone's influencing, someone's leading it. So the question is who and why should there be, why should that person be in charge? So if we go back into Genesis and God ordered it up with Adam and kind of goes on and on through some other cases, there is an order. And if you want your team to run well, you want to have clarity on the roles of who people are. That is such a profound gift. Like, I'm sure you've had bosses and not had clarity on your role. It's one of the most miserable places. What am I supposed to do? What's my job? I don't know. I feel confused, right? Can you imagine if you were on a team and you didn't know what your role was when the ball came to you, like the confusion that you would have? Or if you were in the military, you didn't know what to do when the gut bullets started flying. And so we have walked away from this conversation, and the result is confusion. And we're in an age where it's really clear there's confusion about what male and female is in the general world. But I think we've underestimated it, how much confusion we have in our even Christian households. We are confused about what the male role is, what the female role is. And so there's a lot of confusion, and it's making things really difficult.
Yeah. What comes to mind when you talk about a leader, when you're having a leader, is simply if you're trying to do something, if you're on any sort of mission, if there is a vision ever, then a leader emerges. You can think of having all of the geese hanging around the pond, and they're walking around, eating what they can, pooping wherever. They're just milling around. There's no leader present. When there's something they have to do, which is we're going somewhere, and they all go into the sky, suddenly they get into that V formation, and we've got a leader because they're trying to do something. And so the idea of being on mission with a vision and having a leader, those things go hand in hand. And it seems to me, certainly a topic we talk about a lot, if we're trying to go somewhere, we're trying to accomplish something as a family team, then a leader is utterly necessary. So who does the world say should be leading that team?
Nobody, really. You know, there shouldn't be a leader. And so that creates the confusion. But then in truth, there always is a leader. I always tell families, just ask your kids who's the leader. They'll tell you. They absolutely know who the dominant one is, who they're looking through. When decisions need to be made. There is a leader on every team. It may be a very weak leader, or it might be a very, very strong leader that's out of order in the way that God has designed it. But there's just, it's really an act of faith. Like, you and I could brainstorm all the ideas of why we think it's a good idea. But for me, what I've done is I'm saying, you know, in many ways, my wife is a very fantastic leader, and she does use her leadership gifts. In many ways, she could probably lead the family better than I could. You know, so but by faith, I'm choosing to lead the family because of the order that God has created.
I think that's an important distinction, Justin. So you would say, I think, that Shelley, your wife, leads all kinds of things. She leads projects. She leads people. She has vision. She's skilled and talented. She just doesn't happen to lead the project, which is your family. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's very good to say. She's led our co-op for a couple years. Like, she's a very good leader. And so the problem is, if we say someone's leading the family, what happens is we've hit the nuclear button and said, a woman is worthless and has no value and is a doormat. If you were on the Bengals, since we're Cincinnati people here, you would be like, okay, Joe Burrow probably should be leading this team, and he probably should be paid more than a guy on the practice squad. He's probably a leader and maybe more valuable to the team than some other people. And we'd all be like, yeah, I think you're right. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But that doesn't mean the guy on the practice squad doesn't have a role and God doesn't love him and he's not important, but they have very different roles, you know? Yeah. And we can't, for whatever reason, that conversation turns into like the nuclear bomb conversation. Like you said, a woman's a doormat and has no value. I was like, where did we get that from? That's TikTok. But that's what happens and shuts the conversation down. And the whole conversation is going, then becomes, I've been in so many times where then it's like, no, women are valuable. You're made in the image of God. And it's taken, at least in our community, it's taken years for the women to be like, oh yeah, I actually believe that. And I'm walking in that. And yes, my husband is incredibly leading and perfectly, but man, there's a freedom and a gift when I'm walking in God's will.
Yeah. Let me ask you a couple of specific questions. Is it good for a woman when the 5-year-old is leading the family?
Definitely not.
Why is that?
I mean, you can imagine the maturity and the selfishness that would be in that 5-year-old. They would have no perspective to how to lead a family.
You want to talk about a tyrant. Certainly some men can be a tyrant, but all 5-year-olds will be tyrants if they're given control of things. The hope, obviously, is that you would have a man who has matured past 5-year-old mindset, who can put others before himself and look for the mission of the home before himself, which if anybody participates in the raising of several children, you can attest to this, and is involved at all, it is a specifically designed course by God to squeeze self out of a human being. So a man who is being shaped by God could be trusted with leadership. Certainly the more and more that self gets squeezed out of his schedule and out of his wants, going to sleep and waking up by the demands of children for years and years on end. Let me ask another specific question about family leadership. Is it good for a woman if she's leading the family? Is that better for her?
No. And this is so important because in the Genesis, as part of the curses, you have the story with Adam. Adam sat around and forgo his leadership and was passive the whole time the serpent was there. And then part of the woman's curse is that she would have desire for her husband's rule, desire to rule over him. So you have this dance that is present in almost every marriage, where you have the man's bent towards passivity, the woman's bent towards control, and that dance just goes around in a circle. And when both parties, 50% say, as a man, I'm going to step up and not be passive, and the wife says, I'm going to stop and let go of control, you're walking into God's order. I remember when Shelly and I were in the original dance and trying to figure this thing out. And I remember once Shelly was like, okay, I'm just going to trust God that this is the right order. And we were getting ready for this to buy one of the first houses in our rental property. And Shelly, we were talking about it. Of course, being a leader means, of course, you want to hear every team member's opinions and thoughts. It does, of course, if he feels like these are obvious things we shouldn't have to say. But so we were talking about it. She's like, Justin, it doesn't feel right to me. It doesn't feel right to me. And I was like, oh, no, I think you're wrong. And she's like, oh, okay, you're the leader. You make the decision. So I went forward with the decision, and it turned out to be a bad decision that cost me money to get out of it. It turned out that my wife was actually right, and I was wrong. So when that happened, I remember we were on a retreat up in North Carolina, and I was just walking. I was just processing this whole situation, like, what just happened, you know? And out of my deep soul, I just said, I'm an extrovert, so I have to say it out loud till I know what I'm actually thinking, you know? So I just said to God, like, I'm so mad, God. I wanted to go back to the old way where I can just blame my wife for all my problems. Now I have to take responsibility for this decision. You know, I said that out loud, and I was like, whoa. My heart was like, it's easier. It's actually easier for me just to blame my wife. She won't let me do anything. And I had to be discipled. And what I encourage is, like, if a woman lets a man make the decision and he's wrong, it's actually better for the family, better for her. Because what happened to me, I actually got mature in business. There were things I didn't know and didn't understand. And I could go a couple more stories along those lines. The gift is trusting God's order, that God is going to disciple me through that. It's like the upside down nature of the king. Whenever she strives for control, to take control, she gets less power, less goodness. So for both of us, when we're in this system, trusting that it's God's ways, not measuring it based on ability or talent, trusting God's order, that's the way he's discipling us. It's a very powerful way to think about this stuff. And so we've seen it on both of our ends. When we're both right, both wrong, whatever it is, God is working through this system, and there's a real power in order. And one of the testaments that you'll see if your house is in order is that your kids will want to have kids. If you grow up in a strong matriarch family, you'll see the men will not want to have, the boy children will not want to have kids. Because something feels, even if the house is well ordered, well led, well, whatever it might be, like it, the God's order does actually matter for the fruitfulness of your kingdom.
I think this is such a helpful visual. The hierarchy that you're describing is mentioned in 1 Corinthians 11:3, and it describes in the household, the kingdom of God structure, there's God who's above a male, who's above a female. And that's not a value, as you said, that's not a value statement. It's a hierarchy. It's an order for getting things done. Proverbs 31 says that this noble woman is worth more than jewels. She's worth more than rubies. She's clothed with dignity and honor. She's this wonderful, valuable person, but there's this order. And when a man, so I always, when I'm trying to talk to young guys about this order, I always say, imagine tennis balls connected with a string. And if it goes God, man, woman, and let's just imagine that being straight under God is where the most blessing and favor comes. If you're straight in a line, when the man gets out of order and he pulls off to the side, he's taking his family out of God's favor and blessing to some degree. And he takes his wife with him because she's under him. Sometimes when women see this happening and they can feel, well, my husband's not leading our family toward the Lord, their move is that they want to individually come out from under their husband and back towards what they remember or envision be, this would be the blessing of God here. And what they're actually doing is helping to guarantee that their husbands stay in the place that they're in because they've left them. And there's a dynamic that's described in 1 Peter 3, which is even if your husband's out of line, the best move for you would be to pull straight down on him. Just think of the pressure on that string. If you're straight below him, it creates this pressure that will pull him down to where he's supposed to be, which is back under God and getting that full measure of blessing. Does that translate to you?
Yeah. So you think about things. Men have a responsibility. They have to lead, right? And you're describing if the man becomes passive, then the woman says, well, I have to do the right thing. And
yes.
It becomes controlling. But the scripture says, I don't know if this is the one you're referencing, but it says, if you have an unbelieving husband,
that's it.
Love him. It's like the other, so if you want to change your husband, love him. Don't step into his role. Let the consequences of his choices hit him in the face. That's the most loving thing you as a wife is love him and let God deal with him. Don't play the role of God and try to disciple your husband. And the same thing goes for men to women, like older women teaching younger women. You know, like there's an order in so much of this that when we're off, it's just not fruitful. If you, there's a way you got to trust. I mean, I would, it's hard pill to swallow. Say you have an unbelieving husband who's being passive. Well, love him. I would never personally give that advice.
Right.
Unless it was in the Bible.
If it wasn't already there.
Yeah. If it's terrible, I feel guilty saying that, you know, but yes. I just choose to say, I think God has it this way. This is the order, you know.
I heard you say something one time that stuck with me, and it was, that many fathers stick their wives with the kind of task of mom as perpetual babysitter. What did you say about that?
So if you think about the order of the family in Genesis, the family was designed to work together. Like God said, you two, here's a garden. I'm going to put you next to each other. Okay, and then guess what? I want some kids, and there's going to be some kids around or in this garden working. So the question is, where is everybody together? Okay,
yeah.
So I tell every dad, this was what I got from Chuck Moore when he was a mentor, and I was told him I was going on this mission trip, and he was like, well, just so you know, I was like, I'm doing God's work on this, and it was a good thing, whatever. He goes, you're abandoning your family for a week. You need to decide how you're going to make up for that. I like fell back in my chair, said, what? That's no, I'm serving God. He's like, no, you're abandoning your family for a week.
Wow.
And you need to decide how you're going to make up for that. That changed my whole paradigm, how this whole family thing worked. So if you are a man and it's unfortunate, but in our culture, and many men have to go to work and leave their family for a week, I just tell every man I'm discipling, you're abandoning your family for 8 hours. It is now your responsibility to figure out how you're going to help solve and mitigate the debt you're creating.
Yeah.
God was never, 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 never designed. We go back to Proverbs 31 for a woman to be home alone all day, outnumbered by a bunch of children. We are outside of God's design with that. Proverbs 31, I ask this question all the time to people. What did the Proverbs 31 woman do in the morning? And nobody ever knows. I've asked people who lead women, like we skip over lines that we don't like in the Bible, you know. And everyone's like, is it her quiet time? I said, no, it wasn't her quiet time, according to the scripture, you know.
Right.
It was like she got up and made work or made food for her servants. She was never alone. It is actually a bad leadership if we have these unfair expectations on our wives that they should be thriving home alone with five kids. I challenge every dad I'm with, like, go spend all day with your kids and then come talk to me how you're feeling. And they're like, they're white. They are like, I barely made it. I almost, you know, I'm like, now you know. So stop acting like she's got the easier job or whatever it is, you know. So I really think I do a lot to have my kids around me as much as I can. For many reasons. One of them is because that's how I can disciple them. Yeah.
So how do you do that?
I will take them to work. I will take them to the store. I will come home in the evening and what the evening activities are. I'm fully present or they come with me as much or however they can. Even if they don't want to, you know, they've got to come with me to places because that's how they're going to spend time with me, which is good for me, good for them, and good for my wife. She gets a break. She goes away a lot. She's super introverted. I'll send her away. She'll go to our cabin, have like 24 hours for it, recharge, and I'll take all the kids. And that means they come to work with me. It's really hard, but it's really good.
Tell us about your career change specifically with relationship to your wife. And what were you doing? How are you arranging your life so that your kids could be with you and you could alleviate the stress of mothering?
Yeah. So I left my job at a local church here because I felt like I was really frankly inspired by the story in the garden. Said, and I felt like God asked me this question, like, what would happen if a father came home, you know, to live in the design and how it was meant to be? And so we started buying rental properties. And so we took the whole family to work together. So when Henry or Layla or Adria were acting up, I was there to discipline them at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. And sometimes most of our rental properties, were, especially in that day, were right next to our house. So if there was a problem, I would literally leave the job site, come home, discipline one of my children. And I was really pissed because now I'm leaving work and it's costing our family. It's costing our family money and time because you're being a fool in my house, you know. So that doesn't have to happen very often. As a dad, I'm always telling dads, like, do not hesitate to come home one time and make it very unpleasant for your children. Because the next time mom just has to say, do I need to call dad? Okay, I'm good. I'm good. No, I'll get in line. Right. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, that there, you'd have to be super creative in our culture, how you're going to be a team to support her. And so my wife would, I think, would say, I don't feel alone. I feel a shared weight of this responsibility. And when she started to trust me, you know, choosing to trust me, again, some of it was good decisions I was making, but mainly it was a story that she was trusting God.
Yeah.
There was a lot of weight that started coming off her shoulders. And there's things now that she'll think, she's, I don't even think about that anymore. Oh, thank you. We lay too much on our wives. And so that is really, really unfortunate.
Let me ask you another couple. I've heard you say specific things in passing, which I'm just going to throw at you and make you respond to. I've heard you comment about how does a woman make a meal with a 9-month-old or a 15-month-old that she's got to be tending to every minute. What's your answer to that question?
When I see a family with one child and I say, do you want to know the most important thing you can do to be a better parent? And they're like, yeah, what is it? What is it? And I say, have another kid. You are giving this child too much attention. You know, you are spoiling them. And we're creating narcissistic monsters that need constant attention and reinforcement. You know,
yes.
It is super good for a kid, a 9-month-old, to sit in a pack and play for 30 minutes and entertain themselves.
Yes.
That is actually, you don't understand the gift you're giving them. If they feel that they're like super selfish, if they're like, I can pull this string and get all the attention I want from mom, of course they're going to do that. You're going to give them a gift. If you've got 30 minutes to hear some toys, books, whatever, put them in the pack and play. You can see them while you're cooking and they can sit there and play. And they're going to scream and beg for 5-10 minutes until they know you're not coming. And then
yes.
Bing, ding, timer went off. You can get out. Dinner's cooked, whatever. And then the next day you put them in there. And then what you're going to see is they're going to get the gift of learning how to entertain themselves and be content of just being. Where
yes.
You're creating a monster by giving them constant attention all the time.
I have to throw this in. We mentioned this family a lot because they're close to me. I know them. You know, I have current events on their life. It's the Bosa's yours with number 9, who's now in play, and they have so much going on with these kids that the youngest kids, if you're in like a pack and play, if you're that age, you're like pre-toddler age, when of course they get held and kissed and all that stuff, but if it's action time and everybody's loading in the car and it's hockey practice and all that stuff, those little kids, they get no attention. I mean, they might get a ball bounced on their forehead occasionally, but when there's a lot of action, they're just there. And I have to say, I just rode with them for a couple of hours. Those little things are the most heavenly, docile, they're just pleasant. They're just kind of looking at the world like, isn't today a beautiful day? They just kind of have this serenity to them, which is so amazing. They're actually going, this is how crazy this couple is. They're going away for like a 4-day, they have 9 kids, 2 of them below the age of 18 months. They're going away for a weekend together and they're farming out their kids. And I'm taking the youngest one. And my wife has an event that weekend and I'm not concerned at all. Me and number 9, Gordy, who's named for Gordy Howe, number 9.
Detroit.
That's right. We're going to get along just fine. This kid is no trouble. Which what you're bringing up is something I wondered if we would touch on, which is when you start talking about running a family in such a way that your wife blossoms and she feels cared for. There's a security and a trust that she has with the leader of the family. You cannot talk about having a scenario in which the wife is blooming and feeling cared for that you are not training the kids and that you are not disciplining and training those kids, because they can be a massive, everlasting, bottomless pit drain on all of mom's emotional needs, all of her energy, and it never ends. Or you can create kids who are a blessing, who are, they're happy because they don't demand much. They're happy, they're compliant, and so they respond to orders, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, we'd have to make the same caveats for the kids that we make for the mom up front, which is we're not talking about crushing kids. We're not talking about that they have no value. We're not talking about unhappy automatons, but there is a way to train your children in a way that there's contentment. There's great joy in them.
Yeah, I'll say two things. One of the lenses I take parenting advice through is, if I was poor with 10 children, could I do what you're telling me to do? And if the answer is yes, I'm like, I'll consider it as potentially important. If the answer is no, then I'm thinking it might be an okay thing to do, but it's not critical, to your point. We are way, way over parenting this thing. I'll give one specific example about being a blessing. On our Shabbat meal, on our Friday night meal, I read Proverbs 31 over Shelley as a blessing, not as an expectation list, as a blessing. And she receives it as a blessing. And one of the lines says, her children rise up and call her blessed. And when we do that, and we've done this for years and years at this point, everybody, the kids push away their chairs, stand up on top of their chairs, and they look at their mom and say, I love you, mom. And not once has she not smiled ear to ear from this whole thing, you know? And again, I didn't create this idea. I didn't make it up. I can't write a book and say this was Justin's idea. All I did was read the book. And I was like, let's do what it says.
It says and rise up.
Rise up and do it. Like, so simple and so beautiful, so fruitful. Like, it means so much to her. Every week, she's not tired of it, you know? And so, like, these are things where it's like, okay, yeah, this is really, really beautiful. Yes.
On that training note, you have talked before about involving your kids into your work processes of your home. And can you just describe to us how that can be a blessing to a mom?
Yeah, especially, again, it depends how your wife is wired. I am just more like a coach. That's just kind of my gifting as a coach and a teacher. And Shelley would say this. She would say, Justin, all the things we would do, I would never do if you didn't shoulder the leadership and the work and the energy to get them started. Once you get them started, she's happy to help maintain some of the systems we did. So again, I didn't leave work and say, train the kids how to make pancakes or you have them do this. You know, I get involved, very, very involved in the early systems, in the early coaching, the early feedback of things. So one of our crucibles has been our breakfast meal. We've done breakfast together as a family for 18 years or 16, something. Henry's 18, so it's been a long time. And all the kids participate in it, and largely it's a younger kid activity. And so the two younger boys who are 8 and 9 shoulder most of the breakfast load right now. And it's my job to get up in the morning with them and make sure they're doing their job, enact the discipline when it will happen, because they don't know how to do it yet. You know, they get lazy and whatever. They have their sinners just like your kids and my kids and every kid, you know, and they're going to need that coaching, the encouragement and the carrot and the stick. And I shoulder that weight. And then if I'm not there, it works without me. You know? And then she can help maintain that system.
You recently wrote out two sort of parables that describe different life paths. Mm-hmm. Where one can follow the American system of development for a girl. And then there's the what we think of as the traditional or the biblical model of what a girl's life could be like in 2025. Would you mind reading those to us?
Yeah, I will. And again, it really goes back to the story that's shaping you. So you could let the culture American story shape you, that you're an individual. And the most important thing is you and your happiness and your passions being fulfilled.
Right.
Or there's a whole different story, which is there's a biblical story that says when you lose your life, you will find it. And the way God has designed this thing, especially for a woman, there's no more practical, better way of doing it than having children.
Right.
Unreal. I mean, it's what I always tell men, we can't understand this thing. And so these are just two stories that are helping us see the difference, what happens if you believe a different story. So I'll read this. Emma grew up in a suburb outside of Chicago. She had a sister and a brother. And as a young girl, she played with dolls. She was kept busy with activities in school as she grew up. The primary message she heard was, "What do you want to be when you grow up? You can be anything you want to be. What are you passionate about? What makes you happy?" Emma gravitated towards playing soccer and debate club. She made great friends and enjoyed overnight travel trips for soccer and debate. She participated in her church youth group when her schedule permitted. And a highlight was a mission trip to Mexico to serve at an orphanage. As college approached, the same narrative was told to her. Passionate, happy. You can make a difference in the world. If family or marriage were mentioned, it would occur many years later. Emma did well at college and had much fun with her sorority sisters. She played club soccer and got into the pre-law program. She passed the bar and ended up at Loyal Law School. Emma applied herself and landed a job in a law firm in New York City. She set her goal of becoming a partner and put in time to rise in the ranks. There were a couple boyfriends over the years, but nothing became too serious with her busy schedule. Emma enjoyed traveling and took week-long ski trips to the mountains of Colorado. As Emma approached her late 30s, she had a nagging sense of marriage and children. She discussed the topic with Tim, her boyfriend, and with whom she shared an apartment in New York City. It caused some heated, soul-searching, knock-down, drag-out fights. They were very concerned about giving up their freedom to travel and hang out with friends. They ultimately decided to get married and try to have one child. After a long battle with fertility treatments, they had a daughter. They were good parents and raised her with all the opportunities they had. They retired to a vibrant community in Arizona, playing pickleball a couple days a week. They saw their daughter a few times a year as she was busy with her life and career. Tim died at the age of 77, and eventually Emma was moved into a nursing home to get help she needed. Her daughter visited her twice a year and handled the details of her care remotely. Emma had lived a full life and had much to be proud of and died at 84 years old. It was a small funeral attended by her daughter and a few members of the nursing home. All right, story number two. Abigail grew up in Cincinnati. She had two older brothers. Her family was a typical middle-class family with a busy school, sports, activities, and church schedule. When she was four, her father radically shifted his beliefs about the value of family and children. When the question of what you want to be when you grow up was asked, motherhood was celebrated and valued. Abigail would spend time babysitting for other families, fostering her motherly instinct. She was exposed to various skill training, cooking, gardening, sewing, and typical childhood experience. She had a particular interest in teaching and organizational leadership. On a three-week backpacking trip organized by her family friend's father for 18 to 21-year-olds to talk about their future, Abigail sat next to Thomas on the long van ride, and there was a spark of a relationship. After a process of including their parents and community, they were married when she was 20 and he was 21. They let God decide when they would have children, leading to a quick pregnancy. Over the next 12 years, they had eight children. A whole night of sleep was a rare experience. Now the only people who turned to their heads to notice her were the grandmothers at the grocery store. Abigail experienced a literally dying to herself, as her life was entirely not about her desires and passions. She developed maturity and wisdom to the point that many other young moms would search her out for advice. As time passed, she became more involved in the family business by expanding the training program and improving the organization's systems, increasing profits and income. Life was not easy, but it was full. As her grilled children grew and married and had their own children, the family gatherings required an event space for them all to be together. The accomplishments of her children and grandchildren were impressive. They were involved in every aspect of society, politics, law, business, education, ministry, athletics, arts, etc. Abigail passed away peacefully at the age of 84, surrounded by her family, singing beautiful hymns. They had to set a schedule to visit her in the last week because so many people wanted to be there. She was survived by 8 children, 62 grandchildren, and 12 great-grandchildren. Her legacy continues to this day.
Different stories.
Yeah, very different. Yeah, it brings almost a tear to my eye just thinking about that.
It is so heartwarming. And the main theme, you've already said this, but the main difference I see between those two stories is one asks the question, how can I make the most of myself? How can I maximize who I am and what I can do? And the second story asks the question, what is the most that I can give to the kingdom? How can I serve the king the most in my lifetime? And I certainly feel convicted about having spent years of my life really asking the first question, which is, what am I capable of? What can I do? What would please me the most? How can I arrange my life so that I feel the most maximized and the most validated for who I am? And it's a waste. Ultimately, it's a waste. Okay, so returning to our initial question about what a woman's role is in the patriarchy, and again, all that means is father-led. I don't know what that word conjures up to most people. It's been loaded. It's been purposefully loaded, I think, by the enemy over the last 15 years to conjure up, I don't know, devil's horns or something, or a man with a giant fist. I asked you if it was better for her that her children be running the home. It's better for her that she be running the home. Would you describe for me a second what it would mean to have a woman who is giving herself in the Proverbs 31 way, where she has a good leader over her? He's a good leader. Would you say that she blossoms in that environment? What's it like for a woman in the godly home?
Yeah, I mean, imagine there's so many layers to it. There's just one, trusting, like we've said, God's order. And two, the level of protection that comes when you have that, and a flourishing of who she can become. I mean, we feel so much pressure in our culture because we're so short term. Like, it has to happen all right now. That's why most women can't even read Proverbs 31. They're like, well, I must do this all when I'm 25. And it's like, no. There's a flourishing team that's working together in God's order that will take time and effort to get there, especially if you're starting brand new in this whole thing. But it becomes an incredibly powerful thing. You have Abraham and Sarah, and Sarah, this is in the New Testament, says she rightly called Abraham Lord. And you're kind of like, okay, yeah. It says, okay, so that's in the Bible where you would call your husband Lord. And this is the idea of being the leader of the home, the patriarch word you're using. And there was 1,000 people in Abraham's household, at least 343 fighting men. She was like an incredible COO person. So you have that. And then if you just read Proverbs 31, there's no way I see a beaten down woman with no skills or ability. Right? Like, it really ultimately goes back. I always get nervous of talking about the pluses. Let me sell you on this idea. You know, like, here's all these blessings that come from it, although I believe that they are there. For me, it really comes back to saying, I'm just choosing to trust the story God wrote. And there will be good and bad that comes out of that. But I have to put my stake in the ground. The other alternative is I go and make up my own system. Okay, Shelley, we'll each lead for a year. I'll make up an idea for a year, and then you lead next year. Like, okay, I get the credit for that idea, a terrible idea, but it's all my idea, you know, whatever. You know, we can come up with our own system. So it's like really going back to just trusting how God has done this thing. It will not be easy. I always use like the analogy of dancing. When you learn to dance, you step on each other's feet, and it is so hard in the beginning. And then when you learn how to dance and someone's leading that dance, both people have a beautiful experience with that dance.
I always think of Job 5:7 says that as surely as sparks fly upward, trouble is coming. So it's part of growing up that there's going to be moments when you have your head in your hands and you feel that the end of yourself and you feel you have nothing left to give. There's going to be moments when you have self-doubts and wonder about how did I get this life? What is happening around me? There's going to be those moments either way you go. Whatever path you choose, you're going to have trouble and you're going to have self-doubt and have all that stuff. But as you say, the question is, do you want to make it up as you go along and follow the modern path, which you can read psychology reports and go, they lead to depression, anxiety, alienation, despair. That's for sure that happens. Or you can go, there's an ancient way. We can do what we're commanded to do, stand at the crossroads and look and see if there's an ancient path. And this is one of those ancient paths. And I want the family leaders, the Abrahamic family leaders, to know that you shouldn't feel guilty for leading your wife into the godly path that he's outlined how families work. Nor should a woman be afraid. There's so many women who start with a newlyweds and they go, we just want to follow the Lord. And so she goes, I want you to be my spiritual leader. And he goes, I'm willing to be your pastor. And okay. And so they start down this road. And then when life starts growing up around them, there's a squeeze point where you have to decide whether you really believe the story. Now, if you can fast forward 20 years later, and you're surrounded by, you know, full-grown crops, which are your children who are killing it and they're blessing everywhere, well, great. Well, but when you've got five little ones and you can feel that drowning feeling, there can be a question of, is this the sort of flourishing that I was promised? And so I just want everybody to hear from as many people like you as possible who have been there. You train others in the healthy structure that God has prescribed for us, and you're looking from the other side of the fence, and you're going, "It's okay over here. You're going to die, but in all the good ways. Come on over." You know, I tell you what I'd like to do, Justin, with our time running out. I would like to just read as a blessing the last few verses of Proverbs 31 to our people, and then any closing thoughts from you. Is that okay?
Yeah, sounds great. Let me do my closing thoughts first, and then you do your blessing.
Okay, go ahead. So
I was going to say, there's some things that men and women equally don't understand. And a woman does not typically, in general, understand how lonely and how difficult it is for a man to lead. Almost every man I lead, they'll be like, okay, I'm not going to do this thing, I'm going to lead. And they'll lead, and they'll get like bombarded with criticism and or apathy, and they're like, I just led and it got worse. And I'm like, okay, welcome to the club, you know, like, I'm sorry. You know, so I'm always telling my wife, please tell the wife, I lead other places, business, church, other stuff, and I feel so much more confident than I do within my own family. There's a deep insecurity that a man feels. It's a very lonely and difficult to lead his family.
Yes.
And men don't understand the whole sense of childbirth and that whole process of what it's like to have to submit to an incredibly imperfect man. We don't appreciate that. Like, it's so on both ends, as we're walking through this thing, it goes back to the same thing. Like, you have to walk by faith in this thing. If you're walking by, you know, expected outcomes, you're going to quit, you know. God is so much more in these farming things that are so much, take so much longer to sprout and bear fruit.
Yes. And the cycles, the seasons of the cycles over and over and over again. And you might have a 4-year-old and you go, well, that was terribly painful and I was terrible at it. Well, we're done there. And the Lord would go, that was one cycle of a crop. Let's run it back. Let's do this again. You're going to get good at it, you know. Anyhow, he thinks so long term. I don't know what you've heard, Justin. I've heard conflicting stories about this. The most recent thing I heard was from an Israeli who said that Proverbs 31 was a blessing that Abraham wrote at Sarah's funeral. Have you ever heard that?
I have not, no. It's interesting. And then you,
yeah, I don't, nobody seems to know the origins of this. But anyways, as you say, it's important to remember this is the end of the story. This is looking back at a mature woman who definitely has grandchildren in the context of what's being talked about here. She's running a big successful family that, imagine, in Middle Eastern days would include all of the sons and their wives and all of their kids. So it's a big operation. And here's what it says about her in the closing verses of Proverbs 31. We'll leave you with this. She is clothed with strength and dignity. She can laugh at the days to come. She speaks with wisdom, and faithful instruction is on her tongue. She watches over the affairs of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children arise and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. And he says, "Many women do noble things, but you surpass them all. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. Honor her for all that her hands have done, and let her works bring her praise at the city gate."
Amen. It's beautiful. I read that every week to my wife, and then I literally praise her every week when I'm done. And I will say something every week that she has done. And it's wonderful. It's such a gift.
That's great. Thank you for your time, Justin. We'll
see you
again.
Always fun, buddy.